Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
Yeah, what's up, everybody? We are back.
That's right.
The same spot that we did. This is a couple weeks ago when we were up here.
That's right. I'm following you to Toronto, man.
Yeah, right?
Because I'm usually here in the winter, and...
No, this is a good spot. Yeah. This place is awesome in the summertime.
You need to be here in the summer.
Yeah.
That's right. By the way, we should tell people a big R2C2 news. We have a date for our Papa Shot tournament now.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we do. We
right?
do.
We end of July. We're going to have to do this.
Yeah, and we had to get the rig right, the machine, right?
Yeah.
That shit that you were shooting on. Golly. I mean,
you don't like the mini balls?
I don't even
balls,
think that
like,
shit keeps score, right? Does
no,
it keep score?
No, it keeps score.
You have to tally it up yourself. No, like, is somebody over there tallying up shit?
Somebody's got a pen and pad. Like, Ryan made another.
Oh, man.
No, it's the mini balls, man. The mini balls. That's
nah,
the,
man. That's not flying.
But I'm a little nervous now on, like, playing on the machine at your house because, one, you obviously have a home court advantage.
It wouldn't matter. I mean, we can go to Dave and Buster's. It's up to you.
All right, we'll figure. We know the date. We'll figure out the location.
I just want you to be comfortable with this ass whooping. I don't want no excuses. Like, this is like, you know what I'm saying? It's been a couple years in the making.
That's it.
This is coming.
I'm actually now a little nervous, though, because I saw how good Carter was. And Carter's what, eight?
Carter is good.
Yeah.
I'm not going to lie. Like, the game goes in stages, and then the rim moves, you know, in the last two stages. Him and Jaden the other day, they got 390.
What? See,
together.
Now, the Sabathia genes, man,
yo,
that makes
I
me
was
nervous.
Like, yeah, I mean, I had to go, and I was in the second stage, and I had 302, and then my French Bulldog knocked the
cord out?
Yes.
No.
So then I couldn't even. I was going. I was headed for 450.
What is this, like Rock and Jocks? You get 6 points for a bucket.
Nah,
with those
man.
Scores?
It's 60 seconds. So it's a lot of time. So if you're good,
yeah.
then you're gonna have a high
score.
Oh,
that was like a little challenge.
No, I'm just saying. Like
okay, all right. We'll find out. And are we gonna do a little New York pizza on the way?
Yeah, I mean, that's
so we'll do the double
dip.
Right? Yeah. So after the game, we'll do the New York pizza.
We gotta get Dellen to come.
Yep, Dellen's gotta come. Nimer has got to come.
For sure.
Is Siegel a Papa Shot guy?
I don't know. I mean, he's going to say he is, even if he's not.
Yeah,
so.
That's right. He did. By the way, he just, on a group chat, sent us a message. He found a Joe Carter golf ball randomly on the golf course. Like a Joe Carter labeled golf ball. He's like, what is this? I just got to show you this. Look at this golf ball that he found. With Joe Carter's logo
dope,
on it. It's
yeah.
cool, right? It's a cool
he
logo.
He probably lost that ball and just was like, I'll
yeah, exactly.
drop another one. I get another one out of my
it's
bag.
It's a good golf ball to have. Anyway, today we have on one of my good friends I get to broadcast with, a man who was a multi-time All-Star as a player, is a terrific broadcaster. I know he's someone you like interacting
somebody
with.
Somebody I look up to, yeah, and interact with. And we have a lot of people in common that we are close to.
That's right. Know? So we are super excited to have Ken Singleton. Enjoy our conversation with him here on R2C2. I think Ken already has mastered the craft that you want to master when you're done playing, which is golfing.
Right?
Yeah, exactly.
Nobody masters anything, though.
I feel like the pros are still trying to figure it out, right?
Everybody hits bad shots. For example, I played this week in Long Island. I went to a wedding. And I played with my buddies this week, my buddy from Long Island. The first day I was terrible. And I told him, look, I'll play better the next day because it'll be my second time on the course. I kind of know where to go and where not to go. And I shot like a 78 or 79 this next day. But the first day I was like 90 or 91. It was hot, you know, it was windy. And I didn't know the course. And a couple of guys I was playing weren't very good. So I was just playing to the level of comp. But the next day, the guys were better. We played with some other guys, and I just said, okay, let's get this on. Right from the first hole, I was on.
You give me a 91 any day, and I'm happy.
I'm the same way, man.
I'm locked in.
That's like my best score of all time.
Yeah, but the temperature was about 96 that day, so that kind of drained me right away.
I feel like I get out there. It's the kind of sport where, like, if you don't play all the time, it's just hard to expect much from yourself.
Do you play a lot?
I play as much as possible, and on the days I don't play, I will practice.
Okay.
There's a beautiful driving range not far from my house in Maryland, and I'm not adverse to going out there at 8:30 in the morning, just practice chipping and putting, and then hit some balls and get ready to play my buddies, because we play for lunch.
Yeah.
And I don't want to pay for lunch. I'd rather eat for free like anybody. So, and we have fun. I play with a lot of former teammates, Tippy Martinez, Ross Grimsley. And my best buddy is Al Bunbury.
I know Bunbury.
Little boomer. Little boomer. He's got a good game. He's tough to beat.
And well, I know he's going to talk a lot.
Unbelievable. I'll tell you, I was playing with him one day in Florida, and I hadn't played this course before. It's down near Sarasota. And we got to the 18th hole, and we were tied. So I figured, well, I got to play well on this hole. At least, you know, we'll be even. You know, I won't have to pay for lunch. He won't either. We pay for our own. Well, I hit a good drive. It was a par five. And I said, maybe I can reach it in two. All right? So remember, I hadn't played this hole. I've played this course before.
Right.
So I hit a good shot. It's going and going. I see this splash. And I turned to Alice. Man, you didn't tell me there's water up there. He said, oh, I forgot.
Yeah, right.
So I said, hey, come on, man. So he's kind of smiling. So I drop on the other side of the water, and then I hit a shot. It went in from about 130 yards.
No!
It went in for a birdie, and I beat him anyway.
Oh,
so I said, take that. Take that.
That is terrific.
It's funny. I hit great shots when I play with him. I was playing with him at another course in Maryland. This was in Maryland at Mountain Branch. And he hit a good shot to the green. He had a birdie putt. So I'm hitting from the fairway now, and I'm about 120, 130 out. And I hold it again.
Wow.
And
man,
this is hole number one. And he just turned. And he said, is it going to be like this all day? And he ended up beating me that day because it went downhill. But I was so happy. I just said, okay, we're good.
You're lucky maybe once in your life you hole something from that far away.
Yeah, that's insane.
Do you have any hole-in-ones, Ken?
I have two of them, and one of them was playing with him. And it was at the same course I just mentioned, Mountain Branch. I hit a shot. And I knew I hit a good shot, so I turned right away to go walk back to the cart. And as I'm walking to the cart, he says, you're not going to need your putter. And I said, what are you talking about? He said, do you see your ball on the green? And I didn't see it. I said, man, don't tell me I hit the ball over the green. I hit a good shot. I thought it was good, right on the money. So we're going up to the green, and I reach for my putter out of my bag. You don't need your putter. So I said, what are you talking about? He said, the ball's in the hole. So I walked. Sure enough, there it was. I didn't even see it go in.
You didn't get that satisfaction.
Well, I had two of them. Neither one I saw go in.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I was in an Oriole tournament, same course, different hole, and I hit a shot, and it was kind of really bright. It was over a lake, so there was a lot of reflection. And we were looking for our ball. My group, I was looking for the ball, and then somebody said, go look in the hole. And it was in the hole.
Wow.
And, that was one of those tournaments where they had the television screens, and you could print out your scores.
Yeah.
So I printed out the hole in one, and everybody on the course, you could hear them. They were, oh, Singy got a hole in one.
Oh, that's fun, man.
Yeah, wrong hole. It wasn't the car hole.
Do you have any, C?
No. No. I feel like if I play long enough, I mean,
Then eventually you'll get one. We'll have one when I was 16. Like,
wow.
At Kapalua in Hawaii. I know.
Wow.
Like,
that's a real course.
Right.
Yeah.
It was the fifth hole of the Bay course.
Uh-huh.
And I hit a 5-wood, which is like almost like gives me a demerit getting a hole in one with a 5-wood.
How long was the hole?
It was like 100 and I want to say it was somewhere around 170, but there was a ridiculous wind off the ocean because it's a hole.
Oh, yeah, every time.
It's the signature hole that's right off the ocean, uh-huh. right? And so, and I at that time I had a vicious slice, so I played it to the. It was like the pin placement was back right, so I played it to the front of the green, and.
You're talking
just
like
hit
a pro now.
Yeah, man. It just, I just hit it perfectly, and it's like angling towards that back right. And I'm like watching it. I'm like, man, that I think that might go in. Like that's like, but it's far away, you know. Like, and I can't totally tell. And I'm like waiting to see if it goes in. And there were these people up on. There's like apartments there, you know. And like all of a sudden, I saw these people like jumping up and down. I'm like, oh no, that went in. They were celebrating for me. So I was like. All downhill from there because I'm 31 now. I haven't come close since, but, you know.
So, see, my point is, you know, you didn't get to play all that much because you're still playing. You're active, and you can play pitch as long as you want. But the thing is that after you retire, you're going to have something to do. You
know,
some way to get out of the house, and that's 4 hours. You go out with your buddies. You have a good time.
And that's what I need to get to, like, just to go just practice. Like, in the mornings when I wake up, if I just go to the course or, like, you know.
You ever take lessons?
I have taken lessons a couple of times, but I need to get, like, in that routine where if, like, I go out and chip and putt a couple times.
Are your clubs built for you?
Mm-hmm.
There you go. Yeah. See, I was telling Ryan the same thing. You got to get them
custom,
built for yourself.
Custom clubs, right?
I have to just because of my, you know, being so tall. Yeah,
exactly.
And,
I could see you getting addicted once you're done playing.
Yeah, I mean, I for sure. I'm looking forward to
it. Plus, you get invited to all these tournaments all over the country, you know, and just go and play and meet new people, and, you know, you network throughout the country.
I just want to be able to beat Jeep. Just like you and Bunbury, I want to be able to beat you.
I understand. You know, there's competitive fires will always burn. You know how competitive you are on the mound?
Yeah.
And when you're playing and hitting base and playing baseball, it's the same sort of thing, although you're not a pro at this. You know, but you still have that desire to do well. And, you know, when I play with Grimsley, when four baseball players get together –
I'm sure.
Yeah, it's just the same way. I tell Grimsley all the time about the home run I hit off him, and he don't want to hear it. it's fun. You know, you turn back the clock, and, you know, in a lot of ways, you become a better player than even you were then. You know?
Tell me a story. How long did you and Bunbury play together?
Oh, we played together for 10 years.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, he's the salt of the earth. He'd give you the shirt off his back. He's my best friend. And, you know, he's one of these guys, you don't talk to him for a month, and then all of a sudden you talk, you pick up the conversation right where you left off. You know, just he's a fantastic person.
And I got a chance to know him in the Indians organization. When I first got drafted, I was 17 years old, and he was in the organization and working as outfield and base running coach. And he was our first base coach when I got to the big leagues for a little while, too. So, I got to know
him. He's a hard worker.
Yeah.
Very hard. He doesn't take any nonsense on the baseball field.
And so that's how you knew he would be a guy who talks smack on the golf course.
Of course, 1,000%. Yeah.
I think Earl Weaver rubbed off on him. That's what happened.
Who would be your foursome, C? If you, like, let's say if you were to make it a foursome of teammates who you've played with, who you could see yourself golfing with regularly. Forget geography for a second.
I was about to say it'll probably be Jeet, Andrew, and Sato.
Okay, got you. Andrew Jones?
Yeah.
Nice. And for those who don't know Sato, it's Jorge Posada. Mm-hmm. Most of our audience would know
Andy,
that. But just
I mean, I would have to be – Andy would be in there too.
Oh, yeah,
so
exactly.
I don't think it'd be –
And they let you play five some places.
We got – at some point in my life, me, you, and Andy need to golf.
Okay.
Because, you know, I mean, I kept it under wraps when we had him on the pod back in the day. But, you know, Andy's my guy. Like, that's like – my all-timer right
there. Yeah, I just don't want you to be freaking them out and stuff, man. Like, know?
I kept it cool when we had him on the pod, didn't I?
You did. That
it's funny,
good.
Though. If you look at, like, a lot of my childhood bedroom is still, like, untouched. I mean, some things have been changed, you know, because, like, my mom's like, you sleep in this room however many, like, what, 10 times
they
a year?
They haven't turned
like,
into an office yet?
Not yet. I won't let them.
My kids get out of the house. I'm changing everything. Yeah. I'm throwing it out. I don't want them coming back.
I know what you're doing. Because I've been there. We are there now.
Yeah. Have you changed your kids' rooms yet?
No, just in case they come back for a weekend or something. Yeah. But there's a lot of things. The house is more quiet.
Yeah.
You know, when it gets down to just two people in a big house, I have to call out loud to hear where my wife is. I don't know where she is in the house. You know?
Right.
So, but, you know, enjoy your kids while they're young, see, because they grow up fast. You know, I think you're all aware my daughter just graduated from Penn State, and she got a job in like 10 minutes.
Which is awesome.
Yeah. It is awesome. And she's in California, which is a long way from the East Coast.
Yeah, exactly. You see, I bet you want to keep those rooms for nostalgia for a little bit too, right?
I want to change them into something
really?
That I want. I got plans for these rooms.
Yeah. All right, what are your grand plans for these rooms? What are you going to put in these rooms?
I'm going to make like man caves.
You already have a man cave.
Not like the way I want. As soon as Lil C's out and going to college, I'll turn this room to a man cave.
Really? How big is his room, man?
Nah.
But point being, my childhood bedroom still has like 7 or 8 Andy Pettit plaques up on it. I'm like, you can't take that down. You can't change that. Like I had Yankee wallpaper in there till I was like, I don't even know when I let them finally change that. Maybe
that's
like
great.
24 or something like that. All right, Ken, you brought up Earl Weaver before.
Oh, really?
Who just seems like the craziest character in managerial history. What's a favorite Earl story or two?
Let's see. Do we have enough time? Some of them I can talk about. Some of them I can't. Earl was, the umpires hated him, and he hated them. he got thrown out of more games than any other manager in American League history. 97 times he got thrown out of games.
Oh, my gosh.
And he said, really, it should be 103 because he got thrown out 6 times before the game started. So it didn't count as being thrown out of a game.
How do you even do that?
Well, you get thrown out as you're exchanging the lineup cards.
Six times.
That's awesome. I would have loved to see that.
It was like a weekly occurrence. It got to us. It's got to be old hat, you know. But he had our backs at all times. He used to have a speech every spring training, and by about my fifth year, I knew it word for word. And what he would say was, "It's not your job to argue. Your job is to hit the 3-run homer, or pitch the shutout, or play good defense. My job." I'll do the argument. He loved it. There's some classics that you can pull up on YouTube of him arguing. I mean, and he's cussing at umpires, but, you know, back and forth. And I think my favorite is there was a balk that was called on Mike Flanagan in the first inning, and Earl went out to argue with Bill Howell. And Earl, he must have been out there 15 or 20 minutes because every time he turned to go to the dugout, he turned around, come back, and argue more. And I think Earl told Bill Haller, "I'm going to the Hall of Fame." And Haller said, "What for? For screwing up World Series?" Oh, Earl didn't like that. Because he was 1-2 in World Series.
Oh, man.
Yeah, so.
So he came back for some more after he said that to Earl?
But
now, knowing that he was going out there all the time, did you have to be careful? Like, no, like if you were going to argue a ball or strike, like you made sure that it was a strike. You know what I mean?
No, I will tell you this. It kind of rubbed off on us because we didn't take any smack from umpires on my team, on the Orioles. You weren't afraid to voice your opinion, knowing that he would have your back. He'd be out there in a second trying to keep you in the game.
Okay.
I got tossed out of 2 games, once for fighting and once for arguing balls and strikes. And I got thrown out. I think it was Mike DeMuro, his father, Lou, was an umpire. And he called me out on strike 3. It was a ball. And Earl came out with bases loaded, too.
Every hitter. Yeah, it was a ball.
It was a 3-2 pitch. And
that's right.
And Earl comes out to argue and says, you know, the guy walks 100 times a year. You're going to call him out? You know he's right. Yeah, and he was just going back and forth. But when Eddie Murray got thrown out, Earl would always get thrown out. And we used to call it father-son ejection night. Because he loved him some Eddie. We all loved Eddie.
Yeah.
I mean, Eddie just was the best clutch hitter I've ever been around. And so whenever Eddie got tossed out of a game, which happened because the umpires didn't like Eddie either. He was kind of sour. And, you know, he wasn't a good personality on the field, but he could play. I mean, he's a Hall of Famer, 1,900 runs batted in, all that sort of thing.
Yeah.
He was clutch. But when Eddie got in a bad mood – and he's the only person on the team that Earl would never yell at because he was afraid Eddie would say, okay, I'm not playing.
And Eddie probably would be
I'm not doing it. I'm not doing this today.
Were you ever around Eddie when he was with Cleveland?
He was the hitting coach.
Yeah.
And for a couple of years, I remember, but we're close. We're still close.
Yeah.
Like, you know, he's been, I mean, you know, in Lil C's life ever since he was a kid and stuff. And
he's
in New York all the time. I talk to Eddie all the time. So he's really close to me and Amber, so I got a chance. You know, another guy that you played with
Great
that
hitter.
I'm close with it.
It's funny, it's man, crazy, how it all intersects.
Yeah. I got a good Eddie story. We went to Japan one year on a tour as a team. The Orioles went as a team because we had won the World Series the year before. And we faced Japanese best players they had. We were there for about 2.5 weeks. Eddie hit 9 home runs in 2.5 weeks.
Oh, my gosh.
So they had a couple guys threw pretty well, threw pretty hard. And this one guy for the Tokyo Giants, I can't remember his name because it was too difficult.
But yeah, good luck pronouncing it.
Yeah, he got Eddie 0-2 in Fukuoka, Japan. And he knocked Eddie down right at his helmet. I mean, he was throwing hard.
Ooh.
Helmet came off, bat went flying. Eddie got up, kind of brushed himself off, stared out at the mound, and hit the next pitch out of the stadium. They measured it 540 feet. It rolled down a hill to the base of a lake.
Oh, my gosh.
Straightaway center field. The fans got up to catch the ball. They all turned at once as the ball went out of the stadium.
Oh.
Eddie took like a half hour to get around the base. And you should have seen the look on the Japanese players like, what have we done? You know, just – this is a man you don't want to mess with. So all of us are yelling at the pitcher, throw it me, you know. Just, but he didn't understand what we were saying. But this was, to me, and all the players who were there,
yeah,
the Orioles, we still talk about that. Eddie was the man.
You know, yeah. Just,
Cal Ripken was there. And we talk about it when we see each other.
Yeah.
Man, let's go back to Fukuoka. We'll see if we can find that ball.
Eddie was somebody that I sat on the bench with when he was the hitting coach. And our team would be in the field. I would sit with him, and we would just talk hitting and pitching. It's the same, you know. He would always talk hitting and what guys should be looking for, or who's going to throw this or what. And it kind of like helped me with pitching. You know what I mean? We would just sit there and just talk about the game, literally every day, and it helped me with sequences and just learning how to pitch and like learning the game big time.
One more Eddie story. And he had just struck out, and he was really ticked off. And he sat down next to me on the bench, and I'm the only one he spoke to. He said, next time up, I'm going out of here. And sure, he did it.
Just, wow.
I was on first base, and he won like 9 miles off of somebody, some poor guy.
See,
but he would know what the sequel. He would know how guys were going to pitch him. He would know. Uh-huh. You know what he did the last time off of him, and then you know how he's going to throw him. And he could do that for you. Like if it could be Russell Brain or whoever else, and he'd be like, he's going to throw Russ this, and this.
Wow.
And it would be right on point. And I would have to sit there and figure out to try to pick his brain how he knew that stuff. So we spent a lot of time together.
It just wasn't that he had talent; he had smarts too.
His baseball IQ was off the charts.
That combination made him a great player.
That's interesting. So you're sitting there as a pitcher then. In the dugout with Eddie Murray, kind of like learning, okay, if he's thinking this way, maybe this is how I should sequence this hitter or that hitter or whatever.
Exactly, for sure. You know, if you know he's telling me how to face Juan Gonzalez or whoever else, then that applies to, you know, Vlad Guerrero or whoever else I'm going to face, Manny Ramirez. So it kind of worked like that.
What's up, R2C2 fans? It's your boy Ryan here. With CC putting in work on the mound and me calling his games for years, we've gotten to know each other pretty, pretty well. Whether it's at the stadium or in the studio, we are always trying to knock it out of the park. Uninterrupted and State Farm are getting together to bring you The Sixth Sense, where NBA teammates like Andre Drummond and Stanley Johnson show how they get each other like no other, the way CeCe and I do here on R2C2. Check out Drummond and Johnson's episode as well as the entire series of The Sixth Sense on youtube.com/uninterrupted. And maybe you can get a teammate off the court or off the field that gets you too.
You know, one thing, speaking about CeCe, now let's make believe he's not here.
Yeah, let's make believe he's not here.
One thing I've really admired about him as a pitcher, that he's made this transformation over the years. Mm-hmm. He's kind of reinvented himself. Now, I remember CeCe when he was throwing 90, 99, you know, 100 back in the day and just you can't hit this.
Right.
You understand? But now he's gotten to the point where he's a real pitcher.
Yeah.
But he's still got enough that if you look for the salt, you're not, you know, he can pass you upstairs, moves the ball around better, corner to corner. It's not just right down the middle, you can't hit it. And, you know, I've admired this.
Thank you.
And watched the way you've pitched over these last few years, and I just said, man, this guy can go on for as long as he wants. You know, maybe he's not going to play golf ever.
I think it's just a combination of all that, though. Like learning from, you know, being around these guys and being around Andy and, just trying to, you know, figure out ways to get guys out and coming up with different ways.
It's not only the way you play on the field, it's what you do with the rest of the team. Every team has to have guys that they look to. And, you know, as a veteran player, it's kind of part of your job to pass on. I can recall when, you know, Ripken first came up with us. Mm-hmm. Eddie was a little bit younger than I was, but I was sort of one of the older guys on the team then. So it was my job. And one day Ripken came in, and he threw his bat, threw his helmet, and it was all on TV. Mm. So the next day I brought him in the clubhouse, and I had the guy cue it up. And I said, is this who you want to be? I mean, you're from Baltimore. you want all these kids around here to be like you. Mm. And he never did it again.
Wow.
So that's the sort of thing that veterans should pass down to the younger players. You know, how to comport yourself as a big league baseball player. This is something that, you know, there's – every male in this country grows up to be, most of them want to be baseball players.
Sure.
They wish they could do it, and less than 1% of the population actually gets to the major leagues. So if you're going to be there and you've got all these youngsters out there, you know, if my grandson's watching the game and CeCe's pitching, I'm going to say, watch the way this guy pitches. You know,
right.
Watch the way he comports himself on the mound. Watch the way when they show shots at the dugout, how a younger pitcher might be sitting next to him, you know, getting pointers during the game, or he's helping a younger pitcher in his start. What young guys, my grandson pitches sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And his whole thing, get the ball over the plate, get people out. Some guys, you can't hit it because he throws pretty good. But I said, that's not really pitching. That's kind of throwing.
But,
you know, when you get older, the hitters are going to get better. You got to start pitching. You got to move it to the corner, move it in, move them off the plate, back to the outside, all that sort of thing. He's only 8 years old. He's got a long way.
Yeah.
But this is how, if I'm watching the game and CeCe's pitching, I'm just saying, we're going to tape this so you can watch it in the future.
Yeah.
So.
Thank you. Is that
more satisfying for you, C, now, like knowing kind of that you have to be a little more crafty or your artistry has to be more fine as you work through the lineup?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I get reminded, like, quickly, like the last inning against Atlanta the other day. I was feeling good. Like, I'm out there, we grooving, and I struck the first two hitters out of the inning. And then, like, right when I start feeling it, I'm feeling good. First pitch I throw, I'm like, I'm going to throw this one hard. I'm trying to strike out the side. First pitch, homer. You know what I'm saying? Like,
Camargo, maybe?
Yeah, I get reminded, like, humbled so quick every time. So it's good. It's a good reminder that, you know, I have to stay within myself and still go out and pitch, and I'm not, you know, what I used to be. So it's good. I mean, giving up that homer, like, snapped me back in. It was good. If I would have struck out the side that last game, I would have tried to come out on Monday and been like, like thinking I'm 19 again. You know what I'm saying?
I'm going to blow by you, Machado. Yeah.
No. I came right back.
If you were teaching youngsters to pitch, what sequence would you go in? I mean, command of fastball number one,
yeah.
I guess, right?
I think fastball or command. I mean, command of fastball and then changeup. I think.
Oh, man, how many times have I said that on the air? I feel good now.
I think the changeup is the biggest pitch. I think because we can all spin something at some point. Uh-huh. You could teach somebody how to throw a slider or a slurve or whatever.
Did you always have a good change?
No.
No?
And that's something I learned in the big leagues.
Uh-huh.
Because everything happened so fast for me.
Okay.
When I got drafted, you know, they had to teach me a whole delivery. I didn't know how to throw a four-seamer, a two-seamer,
uh-huh.
anything like that. So they had to teach me everything. And that was the last thing of the development was the changeup. And it just so happened I was in the big leagues when I needed to start throwing it. So it took me like 3 years to throw uh-huh. it. I mean, to learn how to throw it and to get like kind of a master of it. But I wish I would have learned that earlier. Uh-huh. I wish I would have had that coming out of high school.
Now, when you were drafted by Cleveland, number one draft pick, did you kind of know they were on you or did you think other teams were?
I thought I was going to be getting drafted by Cincinnati.
Oh, okay.
And I thought I was going to play first base.
Did you really?
Yeah,
really?
I thought they were going to draft me. I thought I was going to play first base. And then I thought Pittsburgh as a pitcher. But, no, I mean, I had seen the scout from Cleveland a couple times, but never really thought that they uh-huh. were on me like that. So
yeah,
it was a good surprise, a great organization.
Yeah,
I mean, I'm glad that I landed in that spot more than anywhere else. It was perfect spot for me.
Yeah, it's interesting because I grew up in the New York area, and there's a lot of scouts around New York. And there was, remember going to a lot of games, you can see them all sitting up there and stopwatches and everything and pads. And I'm sure it was the same way with you, except in your day, there were radar guns. They didn't have that back. They didn't have that back when I was playing. But the situation is very similar. Scouts have to project about what a player is going to be. And I'll tell you, the guy from Cleveland who put their Indians onto you, he knew what he was doing.
Yes, he did. Ken, uh-huh. Now, Ken, you were a first round pick as
yeah,
well.
Yeah, I was.
And what were you, 3 overall?
Yeah.
Yeah, pretty nice.
That was okay, but in those days they had a winter draft, and yeah. I was drafted in the winter.
Got you.
They had a winter draft?
Yeah, they had 2 drafts during the course of a year.
Oh, I didn't know that.
I was drafted just ahead of Carlton Fisk. He was picked next by the Red Sox. And I was kind of, sort of a hometown pick because the Mets picked me, and I grew up in the New York area. And it was good to be picked by your hometown team.
Yeah.
And then to get to the big leagues with your hometown team. It was good in a way, but the phone kept ringing. You know, my parents were always figuring out the tickets, and other relatives are calling. And I remember when I got traded to Montreal. My mom was crying. You know, it wasn't like nowadays you can watch every game anytime, anywhere. Oh, we'll never see him play again. And my dad was more practical. He says, he's going to go up there. He's going to get to play all the time.
Yeah.
You're going to find out what type of ball player you really are. And he was right, you know. And then,
how many years were you in Montreal before you went to Baltimore?
3 years. 3 cold years. Yeah. Yeah. It was kind of chilly up there. Yeah. But
you stayed there in the wintertime, too.
One year I did, yeah. That cured me, though. I just, from that point, I mean, 30 below is 30 below. I mean, you can't even go outside.
No.
So I moved to California the next year.
This is where baseball is different than the other sports, though, right? Because, like, when you are choosing your city, let's say you're a free agent.
Uh-huh.
At least the majority of the baseball season, you're going to be in warm weather regardless, yeah, right? Yeah. No matter what city you pick, even Detroit, okay? April, May, maybe.
April,
September.
May, brutal.
We were there in April.
Man.
It wasn't good.
Brutal.
But for the most part. But I'm saying, like, when people talk about, like, NBA free agency, I'm always like, weather has to play so much more of a role because the entire season is basically in cold weather.
But I don't think that they don't worry about that because they playing indoors, and it seems like guys don't really worry about that in the NBA.
Well, they're playing indoors, but life is outside.
I know, but I'm just saying though. It seems like
I know they. It doesn't feel like they worry about it.
They don't worry about that
at
all.
You know, you can buy a coat.
I know. wait. Did you just buy a coat and stay in Montreal? You left.
No, I had a big coat. Believe me, a scarf and a hat, and boots and gloves. I had everything up there.
You know, you're talking about before how like Eddie, when he got pissed off, he could just be like, hey, yeah. I'm going to go hit a home run. And that's funny because that's something I wrote down in my little notebook that CeCe loves.
Uh-huh.
That I wanted to ask both of you if like how being pissed off affects your performance. Like can you actually – like if there's a common trend for what it does to you.
It makes me horrible. I can't function being pissed off anywhere in life. Mm-hmm. Like, you know what I'm saying? Especially on the mound. I have to be – I have to be under control, and when I'm pissed off, I'm not in control.
So what do you do if you feel yourself starting to get pissed off on the mound? What do you do? Yeah,
I won't let it. Like I won't like that whole day. You know, like driving into the park, waking up, doing everything. I make sure that I'm in a good mood. Seriously, like me and Chad mm-hmm. talked about our mental conditioning coach. Like I won't even like if I'm driving into the park, I won't even honk at anybody if they cut me off or anything like that. Like you know what I'm saying? Like I put myself in a space where I'm not going. Like nothing's going to affect me. I'm not going to let a bad call. I'm not going to let a check swing. I'm not going to let a swinging bunt. I'm not going to let anything get in the way of what I'm trying to do and focus and lock in to win this game.
Were you always that way or
no,
did it take a while to develop
not.
It?
No, yeah. I mean, it's taken me 18 years to get to that point. Like, no, I mean, and that was something that was like a big deal when I was younger in Cleveland is my anger, you know, or one call messing up a game, you know what I mean? Or just something that, you know, me getting pissed off at a player and you know, not being able to throw strikes. That was something that was a big deal for me. I had to really figure out.
Don't sweat the small stuff. You know, the whole idea is to win the game, and the only way you're going to do it is be able to focus during the whole game.
Yeah.
You know, because if you take a strikeout with you out to the outfield and you're worried about that, all of a sudden you're chasing down a ball in a gap maybe you should have caught.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I just there were times – my manager would tick me off. he would tick me off. But I tried to even let that go in one ear and out the other. To give you an example, I missed a fly ball in Chicago one day. Just easy fly ball. Hit my glove. Fell out. And the White Sox didn't even score. So I come back to the dugout. I feel pretty good. They didn't score.
Yeah.
But here comes Earl. And he's, what the hell are you doing out there? I said, I got no excuse. The ball just hit my glove. It fell out. And I was trying to be chill about it.
Yeah.
I said, they didn't even score. But he's not that way. You know, you got to play the game right. So he says, you know, you want to look bad in front of 35,000 people? I said, no, not really. He said, well, you just did. You didn't look very good. I said, Earl, you know, there's bigger things to do here today. I said, number one, I'm hitting this inning. You better leave me alone. And then he thought about it, and he said, yeah, go ahead. He knew what was important, you know? So it was more important for me to get a hit than actually a fly ball that was inconsequential during the course of this game. So CeCe's right. You can't function on the field. You got to have all your faculties working, concentration working, if you're going to be successful on the field. My wife says to me, you can remember pitches and sequences from 30 and 40 years ago, and you can't remember today's garbage day. And I said, because, you know, if I'm not concentrating and if I'm, you know, up there halfway thinking about things, somebody can hit me in the head and kill me. So you got to concentrate with Nolan Ryan on the mound. Mm-hmm. And that's when you focus the best, I thought, when I was playing, when I was focused the best.
I always, speaking of Nolan Ryan, who was the best pitcher from that era? Who was the guy that you hated to face?
Ron Guidry. He was tough.
Was he?
It was so bad, see, I would tell you, when I came to New York with the Orioles, I would stay with my parents at their home in New York where I grew up. And I'm going to the stadium, getting ready to drive down the stadium. My dad would say, you know who's pitching tonight, don't you? I said, yeah. He says, you think you get a hit? I said, well, maybe he'll walk me. But I did hit one home run off him and basically hit my bat. You know, Guidry was tough. There's a lot of guys. Steve Carlton was tough. But there were big-time Hall of Fame pitchers that because the challenge is there. When you're facing the top guys like Bob Gibson and Tom Seaver and Nolan and, you know, Carlton and all these guys. And Fergie Jenkins. He had power and control.
I looked up the numbers just so we have them officially. Whoa. You versus Ron, Ken, to back it up. You did have three doubles off him. Yeah. You did have the one home run, but 9 for 54, so 167 with 10 Ks. So you remember it correctly.
I would have been a 300 hitter against the Yankees if it wasn't for him. Guys, like, I remember meeting Gibson a couple of years ago. The Yankees were in St. Louis, one of the rare times to go to St. Louis to play interleague game. And I ran into Bob in the lobby of the hotel, and he was with his wife. So we sat down, we talked a little bit, and he still had that glare, man. He looked at me and says, I used to have problems with you. And I just thought to myself, well, he's not going to get me now. Because my first game facing Bob Gibson, I was with the Mets, and Don Clendenin, we're in the tunnel getting ready to – game's going to start. He says, kid, if you hit the ball hard against Gibson, make sure it's fair. Because if you pull it foul, that next pitch is going to be right at your neck. Oh. So I just remember that. And every ball I hit off him hard was fair. And I think I hit 340 against him in my career.
Wow.
But I never hit a home run off him because I really didn't want to take him
off. You didn't want to hit him.
And he was not only a great pitcher, he was a great hitter. He beat us 2-1 one day. He hit two home runs.
Really?
And it might have been a shutout. He might have shut us out 2-0, and he hit two home runs.
I didn't know he could hit. But
no, he's a good hitter, too.
But that was like a – I mean, I don't feel like there's guys in the game like that anymore. You know what I mean? Where it's just like, you know, a Bob Gibson, a Tom Seaver, or –
A Marichal.
Marichal
was tough, too.
Yeah.
Yeah, he told me a story. This is Juan talking to me.
Okay.
Now, he said that I hit two home runs off him, right? And early in my career, one with the Mets, I think both with the Mets. And years later, I played in his golf tournament in the Dominican Republic. Mm-hmm. And we're at his house, and he says, you know, I didn't like young guys hitting home runs off me. And I said, do you like old guys hitting home runs? He said, I don't like anybody hitting home runs off me. And he said, I was going to knock you down, but – my wife thought you were cute, so I figured I'd get in trouble at home. So I walked over to his wife. I said, thank you very much. Nice to meet you.
That's a terrific story.
Yeah, he was a tough pitcher, too. He had a screwball.
Really?
He had everything, man. He had that windup, which is very unusual. It was hard to pick up the ball. And not only that, he was my favorite pitcher growing up. So to hit a home run off your favorite pitcher, Marichal, plus he's in the Hall of Fame too.
Yeah.
Now, so he was great.
That's
great.
Pretty cool. Like, to hit a home run off your favorite pitcher. Yeah. Like, who was your favorite hitter growing up?
Griffey.
Griffey. Yeah. So what was it like when you faced him?
Man, the very first time I faced him was in spring training. It was my first spring training game, and I came out of the bullpen. It was like one of the only two times I've ever literally came out of the bullpen, and he was the first hitter.
And you're what, 19?
Yeah, I was 19. He I was, hit him in the back.
No.
I wanted to cry. I was so like, I didn't know what to do.
Are you serious?
Because I'm like, I need to strike him out, right? Like, I have to, like, because all my boys are going, I can't let him hit a homer. So I'm throwing the ball as hard as I can, and it just slipped out of my hand, man.
Oh, my
God. And I hit him right in the back, and he was pissed. And I just wanted to go and, like, hey, see, I'm so sorry.
That's what all pitchers say. It slipped. You talk to any hitter.
Man.
I know. It's like the first excuse out of the box. It slipped. You know?
I felt so bad, man. That was horrible. But we ended up, you know, we're friends now, and he laughs about it now. But, yeah, I was so hyped, and I just couldn't – I didn't know what to do, man.
He's a good golfer, too.
He's a great golfer. Yeah.
Is he really?
Yeah.
His swing – you know, he is the – he's the first opponent I ever went to a game to see. Because, like, growing up – you know, I grew up a diehard Yankee fan. I'm growing up in the New York area. I never cared about the opponent. If I'm going to the game, and I was fortunate enough to go to a good amount of games, it was always about, like, just seeing the Yankees. Like, that's why I'm going.
Yeah.
And I'm growing up in the late 90s with all the championships, right? The first time I ever cared who they were playing when I went to a game was Seattle, so I could see Ken Griffey.
Every time they came to Oakland.
Yeah,
I always would go see him, especially because they had Randy Johnson too. So my mom was a big Ken Griffey Jr. fan. So anytime they came in town, she would take me.
His dad was a good player too.
I mean,
he was solid hitter, not the power that his son had, but he was a very good hitter, line drive type hitter. Back in the days when hitters were actually trying to hit singles and doubles. Now everybody's trying to go deep, and I think in a lot of ways now the hitters are kind of playing into the hands of the pitchers. I mean, there's more pitchers who throw hard. There's no doubt about that nowadays. When I was playing, there was a lot of guys sinker, slider, you know, especially out of the bullpens. Now there's people in bullpens you don't want to see. You don't want them to come in the game. And every team is trying to load up on 95-plus out of the bullpen. And that's why I think you're getting a lot of strikeouts, especially with these everybody trying to hit the ball out of the park with the launch angles. They're kind of playing into the hands of the pitchers, especially the ones who can throw a high hard, like Chad Green. They can't get up there and get it. You know, that's it.
I think guys used to change their approach when they got to two strikes.
And they don't do that anymore.
No. I mean, because you don't have to pitch where guys are trying to put the ball in play. They're still trying to stay within their swing and still trying to hit a home run.
Yeah.
So you don't have to change. You can just still pitch them, you know, like it was 0-1 or 0-2.
That's something that A-Rod talks to us about all the time. It's like having that A swing, B swing, C swing. How, right, guys just always are going with the A swing now, right?
Yeah.
Instead of, like, adjusting to the count or whatever it might
be. Yeah, but for me, I mean, I want Aaron Judge to take the homer swing all the time.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? That's just me. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know. I mean, you know, I'm a pitcher, and obviously our team, you know, we hit a lot of home runs, and you know, I'm on the other side of it. But, I mean, I always want those guys to swing hard as you can.
Yeah.
Well, his C swing is still a home run swing. Yeah, he's just hitting it out to right and right center.
That's true.
Well, we saw that the last game against Atlanta when he homered. That fly ball down the right field line, he ain't come close to getting that. Mm-hmm. But he's just so strong. He is – built for that park, too. The way he has that power to the opposite field.
For sure.
My gosh, man.
I feel like G is, too, once he settles in.
Yeah.
He's got that. I mean, he hits that ball to right center.
Uh-huh.
I mean, he hit that ball the other day. I mean, that was a bomb.
410 to the opposite field.
To right center.
Would you rather hit or have somebody hit for you?
I'd rather hit.
Yeah, I know you would. Yeah. I knew you were going to answer that way because you can hit.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of pitchers who can't.
I know, but if we all hit from the time that we were supposed to in the minor leagues and stuff, guys would be able to hold their own, I feel like, you know.
You're right.
They stop us hitting. I mean, I went from high school hitting, and then I didn't hit again until I was 23 years old. You know what I mean? You got 5 years where you don't hit, but if we hit in that time, I feel like guys could keep their swing up.
I can imagine if I didn't pick up a golf club for 5 years, how I would play.
It's true, though. I mean, it's true. Is that right? See, well, I don't know if Ken's ever heard your idea for if you guys are going to do interleague with pitchers batting, how you would flip it.
I would rather do it where we hit at home.
Just like switch the pitchers it up. Hit at home.
So in the American League, then we play National League rules. So we get to hit in front of our fans. We never get a chance to hit in Yankee Stadium and had a music playing for us and all that stuff. It's always on
the
road.
In other words, reverse the rules.
Reverse the rules. So we play. So if we're playing interleague or Blue Jays playing interleague against the Mets and they hit the pitchers hit at home, I think that'd be cool.
Yeah, you know what? I've kind of that gives the fans in the other stadium a chance to see baseball played the other way too.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
I. That might be interesting. Maybe you should write a letter to Rob Manfred.
Or shoot him a text or something like that. You got the commission on text?
Man, I wish. A-Rod do, I'm sure.
Yeah, that's right. You know he does. Yeah, I think CeCe really just wants a walk-up song. Like that's
I just want to get a chance to hit in Yankee Stadium with that short porch one time.
To walk-up songs. Do you have one in mind?
I got a couple walk-up songs.
They didn't have walk-up songs when I was. The only walk-up song for everybody was the anthem. That was the only song that was played. But I can't even remember who does it. But hard hitting. It's an older song.
Yeah, that would have been your one to go up to.
I wonder who started that and when that started.
That's a great question.
If they didn't do it when you guys played.
No.
Yeah, when did they?
There's
this is something for us to research.
Yeah, right.
Like when did the walk-up song start? That's a good question.
Yeah. Well. Yeah, I'm sure if we you got Google.
Yeah, exactly. I am going to Google that and see if there's any answer
to it. Because I feel like in the '70s, guys should have been like having walk-up songs. And stuff.
Yeah,
that would have been a great time. I feel like that's my era to play in anyway. I feel like I should have played in the '70s.
Yeah, but the games are over at 2.5 hours. With a walk-up song, that makes a 3-hour game.
That's true. That's all the added time right there.
That's true.
I am going to Google this now. Like, when did walk-up songs? Ken, how about like when you would hit? Because I know I love hearing Ken's stories. And just for some background, so I started at YES as an intern at 19, doing stats in the booth when I was 20, and Ken and I hit it off immediately, and now obviously we get to work together doing games, which is amazing. And through these 11 years, I have always loved getting to hear Ken's stories. And one thing that I always find interesting is Ken is maybe the nicest human being I've ever met, but I also know he has this ridiculously competitive streak in him, and I love hearing the stories about when he was on the field. And I know that, much like you were telling the story of, like, Eddie got knocked down, I know there were times where you took someone yard after they did something to you, and you had no problem letting them know about it a little bit, right?
No,
like, give
them
a little look, a little smile, a little glare, something like that.
Well, it wasn't – you'd say things. I remember being thrown at and getting hit, going down to first base, and – just yelling from first base over the pitcher, I'm going to get you. I'm going to tack an L on you one day. It's going to come back. And, they wouldn't look over. They wouldn't throw over. They wouldn't do anything because they knew I meant business.
And that's the guy that did it on purpose, then.
Yeah, he tried
when
to
hit
me.
They don't throw over and they won't look at you. Yeah. Oh, did it on purpose.
Then you know.
I'm going to tack an L on you one day.
And did you?
Yeah, maybe. You get your opportunity. You're going to give it your best shot. Maybe within that at bat. They just miss you.
Yeah.
And then you try to do something. And just I've seen some good comebacks by hitters.
Do you see it's less guys throwing inside now too? I think that's
definitely.
I think that's why reason why the homers are up too. You think that guys need to throw in more? A lot more.
I think there have to be more purpose pitches than because it used. When it got to be 0-2, you expected a pitch to move you off the plate. It was almost expected that the next pitch, And I remember pulling a ball foul in Chicago at Wrigley Field. Went across the street, just missed a home run. And the next pitch was up and in. Next one was up and in. And next one was low one in. And I walked. So I get down to first base, and the first baseman was Jim Hickman. Used to play for the Mets, but he was playing for the Cubs. And he said, I was a young guy. He said, you should take that as a sign of respect because he was afraid of you. After you hit that ball across the street, he didn't want anything to do with you. So he came up and in twice just to make his statement, then two pitches away, and you walked. He didn't want anything to do with you. So take that as a sign of respect, even though you're a young guy, that you hit that ball 450 feet across the street.
I don't have enough for this guy.
Yeah.
That's it. Ken, you have said that this will be your last year at YES, but there has been a swell of momentum from people saying, don't go, including, hey, even our boss, John Filippelli, has been quoted in an article saying, I'm trying to convince him to stay.
Uh-huh.
Is there any chance now? Have you rethought about it at all? Give us some news on R2-C2, Ken.
Well, he's made it very difficult for me not to come back. So, he's trying to convince me. I've talked it over with my wife.
Yeah.
And she said, basically got down to the point, it's up to you.
Okay.
They always do that. Right? Yeah. I was looking for you to give me the answer. Yeah.
See, how long have you been married, C?
15
yeah,
years.
Well, I've been married longer than that. So, but we're in the same boat.
Yeah.
It's up to you. So
I hate that.
You want the answer.
Give me the answer.
Yeah. So Flip can be a very convincing guy.
Yeah.
So we're kind of in the talking stages. I'm not going to say definitely.
Yeah.
But it's I'm kind of leaning – either way, it's kind of 50-50.
He sound like me. Well, he sound like me playing this year.
Right? Exactly, right?
So, you know, I love my job. You know that.
Yep.
I love all the people I work with at Yes.
Yeah.
There's just certain things that have gotten to the point now. My grandson's playing ball. I don't like to miss him, you know, playing a game.
Mm-hmm.
You
yeah.
know, I missed his first home run this year. I didn't see it. So
could you do maybe a little smaller slate or something like that?
That's kind of what we're talking about.
Okay.
So
all right, you're giving us some new. This is going to get some headlines.
It could happen.
You're
that
coming
way.
Back. I can see it. I can see it.
The reason is because I love my job and I like the people I work with.
Yeah,
that'd be the main reason why I would come back. If we could figure this out, where I would work and when I would work. And how many, you know, I would, you
yeah.
know, I still love the job and, you know, hanging around guys like CC and
yeah.
the players, it keeps me young. It keeps me feeling that way at least.
It's fun for us to have you around too. I mean, just with the stories and like, you know, passing down the knowledge and everything else. It's great to have you around. It's great to have Reggie around. It's great to have Gidgey around. It's like, we like that. We love that brotherhood. You know what I mean?
That's
part of it for us.
I do feel, and it's no slight on the players today. But I do feel that you talk about Reggie and Gidry and all those guys. I do feel I played in the best generation of players.
Mm-hmm.
Those were the days when the players were just starting to make inroads into, you know, free agency, arbitration, willing to fight for the rights and say we aren't playing. You know, that's it. And I remember in 1981, 56 days I was home during the summer and just sitting there reading to my boys every night before they went to bed. And I'm thinking, man, are we ever going to play again? You know, just, you know, I'm losing money here. You know, I got this mortgage to pay and all that sort of thing. And, you know, now all those things are gone. The boys are all grown up. There's no more mortgages, you know, all that sort of thing. So, you know, I feel that we have a kinship with the players like Reggie. You know, every time I see I played with Reggie for 1 year. He was with us in Baltimore for 1 year. But that was a special time. It was a very contentious time between the owners and the players. There weren't the revenues that there are now in baseball.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, baseball is a $9 billion a year industry now. Mm. It was nowhere near that.
Well, that's day. Because of you guys.
Yeah. Well, we sat and well, basically, it's because of Yes and all these local networks. And,
no, you but know, you guys networks. Being willing not to play and standing up for the right things.
Yeah.
Is,
well, Marvin Miller was around there.
Yeah, and that's something that we all, you know, appreciate and recognize, I mean, it's something that had to be done, and it's the reason why our game is in such a good place, and the players are in taken care of really well is because of you guys.
Well, the owners used to say that free agency was going to kill baseball. I think free agency made baseball even better.
Yeah.
I mean, it became more of a year-round thing where fans are now willing to, you know, read the where's he going? Where's this guy going to go? Who's he going to sign with? And that keeps baseball in the news all year. I think also it helps ticket sales for teams that sign these players.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when you came to the Yankees, you and Tex and AJ, what happened the first year? Yankees won the World Series.
Yeah.
I mean, that was a big boost. So I just think that in those days, they didn't have that sort of thing. And when it first came around, nobody really knew what was going to happen. The owners were saying it was going to ruin baseball. I knew that my salary went up 2.5 times over what it had been. Previous to free agency, when the Orioles decided to give me a 5-year deal, which nobody in their history had ever gotten. So that, to me, I said, this free agency thing must be a good thing.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm not even going to be a free agent. I'm benefiting because I re-signed. So it's just one of those things. It's gone from there. And you see, I don't mind. Players could make $1 billion a year. I wouldn't mind. There's some fans get upset how much money the players make. The owners make a lot of money, too.
Yeah.
You know, nobody knows what they make. So I just think they wouldn't give the money out unless they had it.
Right.
So
it's all relative to
exactly.
what your entertainment is creating.
It's just and how the game has grown over the years. It's more of a worldwide game now. You have players from all over the world, which I think is a great thing.
Mm-hmm.
I just, you know, we made those trips to Japan for a reason, to try and get people over there interested. And now we've got great Japanese players coming over here, like Ichiro and Matsui, and just you get Tanaka here. I mean,
all their best players want to come here.
Otani's a phenomenon. You know, I heard he's getting healthy enough to hit.
Yeah.
So, I want to see that, but not against us.
We're done for the Angels for now.
And I wanted to see him. I wanted to see him pitch, and he hit that first game, and against Seve, he took that ball inside 97. I was like, all right, that's enough.
Yeah.
He's the real deal. I'm cool. I mean, I watch it on TV now. He's fast.
Yeah, he is fast.
He's such a great athlete. Yeah. It's insane. He's huge.
I've seen enough of this. So, Kenny, this has been amazing. Before we let you go, I'm like,
we're stopping.
Well, I know you see. This is this is the reaction we love. I told you, Kenny, our R2C2 guests, they have a great time. They want to stay and hang.
Oh man, we didn't talk music or anything.
You know what? Yeah, let's go there
next time.
CC knows I'm like slowly trying to like work on him like coming to the booth someday and doing some games and that. You're someone who's made the transition, so you could sell it to C.
I'll tell you how I really got into it. It was towards the end of my career. I knew I was going to have to do something else. And my agent, Ron Shapiro, who's still my agent, who is the father of Mark Shapiro, who's the president of the Toronto Blue Jays.
Who's one of my great mentors.
Yeah. See, you guys really have a lot of ties.
We have a lot in common. Yeah, a lot of ties.
So in Baltimore, you know, the years that we didn't make the playoffs, they would have me on TV on the local news and local sports. You know, saying who I think was going to win the playoff. You know, I was just saying, basically, I kind of, to hedge my bets, I wouldn't really say who's going to win. I just said, this guy's good. You know, this is why they're there. And you can pick on your own. I didn't want anybody losing the house because I said that some team's going to win the World Series. But that's how I sort of got into it and got used to being around a studio and how people talked. Then we had a strike in 81, and that same station gave me a job. They said, well, we need some footage for our local sports, go out and cover little league, softball leagues, all this. Well, I really didn't know what I was doing, but I had a good producer, which really helps, as you know, Ryan.
Yeah.
So I went out and, you know, brought back some footage every day, a minute or two of some action from a local little league. And I kind of got into it from there. And then after I retired, I came right up to Toronto and they interviewed me for TSN. And I started doing Blue Jays and Expos games the very next year, and I've been up in the booth ever since. So
wow.
Yeah. So I kind of got right into it. Right after I was through playing, the next year I was upstairs doing the games. And Tony Kubek was the one who kind of taught me in spring training how to the ropes and, you know, just to get used to being on camera and all that sort of thing and what to do, where to look, and just be natural. It's just – and one thing he told me, when you're on camera, just make believe you're talking to your best friend. You know, there's millions of people behind that camera. But make believe you're talking. It's more conversational. That's what it is. And if you look more relaxed, they're going to be more relaxed. So that's how I got into it.
And it's working out for you. And now we have some news that maybe it'll continue for you. That's right. Yeah. Kenny, thank you so much for doing this,
Thank you guys for inviting me. I really enjoyed myself.
Thank you.
Awesome. Some terrific stories there with Ken, man.
Right, every time.
And we got some news there.
You were trying to push for news, man. He wasn't ready to tell you the news. Like,
no, but
you know what I'm saying?
He could give it to me, or it's going to be the Daily News or the Post or something like that. You know, better off here on R2C2. That's right. We all love working with Ken, so we'll take him for as many years as we can get him. And, you know, we'll take you as listeners for as long as we can get you.
So make sure
you rate, you subscribe, you review. I feel like we maybe should do a giveaway for people who write reviews at some point soon.
Yeah.
Right?
Do we have mugs again? Where are the mugs?
I still got mugs in my apartment.
This guy's over here hoarding the mugs, man. Like, we can give away mugs for people that do a good review.
All right,
it doesn't have to be a good review. You just do a review. If you do a good review, Ryan's going to read it on the air.
And
so.
I'm not sending you a mug if it's a bad review. It's still got to be a positive review. But that's right. All right. So that's what we'll give away some mugs. And then how about maybe we'll do a special, like, maybe you autograph something for
someone. Yeah, for sure.
Like
that'd be dope.
Like a jersey or cleats or something like that?
Yeah.
All right. So we'll do that. Maybe we'll set that up for next episode before the All-Star break. But make sure you review, rate, subscribe, all that good stuff as we continue. We're going weekly here on R2C2.
We've been knocking them out, man.
Yep. We're going to continue to. So keep listening.